strong cup of coffee this morning, so just bear with me. I really am pleased that you would choose to sacrifice your time and a little money to be here. I have been living in New Zealand for the last 3 years. I moved here after being one of 25 pastors with a very large charismatic Anglican church in Singapore, where my family and I resided for the last 7 years. And we moved here 3 years ago, and in my efforts here in New Zealand, while a lot of the work I do is in the mainstream bigger cities, I do try to make special time for what I call the second cities that very often don't have an opportunity to get this kind of teaching especially. And so that's why I am especially pleased that, in light of the fact you could be doing other things for the sake of your own community, you've chosen to be here. And so while I don't presume that I have all the answers on big issues like sexual and relationship problems, I do hope that what I offer will really be an encouragement to you personally, but also for the advancement of God's kingdom. I also enjoy classrooms. I'm a teacher. I have been involved in full-time ministry for 20 years, and I've been traveling between 4 to 6 continents every year for the last 15 years, specializing in equipping God's people in areas of sexual struggle, something, as was mentioned, we're all so very good and redemptive about. Isn't that right? And one thing I love, whether I have bigger seminar events like I did earlier this year with over 1,000, or whether we have a classroom size like this, the point is, you're choosing to be here, and this being a smaller group means that we can have some interaction. So my hope as a teacher is that if I am not clear about something, or if you want to challenge it, I don't mind, but let's just ask questions and have some dialogue that in a larger event would not be possible. So I'm here to serve you. And while I don't know everything, that which I have learned, I offer to you. But if I am not clear, if you want elaboration, then this is your opportunity to ask. Now, with that in mind, I don't want you cornering me during a break and asking for personal counseling and or a little miniature seminar. That is, a lot of people, because we deal with sexual themes, they don't want to ask a question from the floor by virtue that someone might think they have an issue. And so I know that all of you here have no issues. I know that none of you are here because you have any personal struggles, but we're all here for the sake of someone else. I understand that. So, if at any time during the presentation you have a question from the floor, please do not hesitate to ask. Again, help me serve you. And I think that what I find is that the questions that I hear from anybody often apply to everybody. Add to that, if you do have a personal question that you would like to ask on a break, I'm glad to hear your question. I'm not saying you can't talk to me. What I'm saying is I want others to benefit from the question and the answer. So either ask me your question or write it down on paper if you feel that it's a little too personal to ask from the floor. I understand that. And then we'll address it a little bit later in the course of the day. So again, I desire to serve you and to make this time even more personally profitable, if possible. So don't be afraid to ask. But I may not answer you in the break because I want others to benefit from the material. Let's do that. Now take a look at your outline. Before you get underway, there are some important points that I'm going to call your attention to on the very front page called I Want You to Know. And you don't have to read that in detail now, but I do want you to read it. It will give you some important instructions that will relate to today's event and long after it's over. So make sure you take the time to review this front page. Turning through your outline to the very back, you'll see that we have recommended resources listed for you. Long after today is over, there are resources available. Contacts internationally and locally within New Zealand and North Island, which I hope that you will take advantage of. Now, because I do come out of a gay background, and though this is not the topic of our discussion specifically here today, but because there are a lot of questions about that in church culture and in modern society, I do have a second page of recommended reading and useful websites, which gives more specific information for you. Websites and recommended reading covering a variety of sexual redemption themes like sexual abuse and sexual addiction, but also homosexual concerns, whether you're the loved one of a homosexual person, whether you struggle yourself in some way or know someone who does. There are theological as well as clinical and experiential resources listed that you can follow up on. So again, at your leisure, review the information. I hope that it will serve you. And most of these authors and people involved in ministry in these fields, I know them, and I'm glad to stand by them as credible resources for you. So long after today is over, it's nice to know that there is a wealth of material out there if you've not been aware. And there are ways that you can order it locally as well as from the United States. So there you have it. We're going to cover a lot of material. This little innocent-looking outline covers 12 to 18 hours of my seminar material. Often I teach as a guest lecturer in Bible colleges in their counseling for, or the diploma for counseling sectors, and so I have longer to convey information over a week. But obviously we don't have that kind of time today, so there may be portions of this outline that will not be covered. They'll remain blank. But still, at the end of the day, I'm going to try to convey a good package of material for you that when you walk out of here today, you'll have a better understanding of God and His character in relationship to sexual struggles. You'll have a better understanding of why people have problems and, more importantly, what to do about it. And hopefully you'll have a little more insight about yourself, because everybody in the room is a sexual creature. Everybody in the room struggles in relational and sexual ways to some degree. And certainly we all know and care about people who do as well. And that will become clearer throughout the day. And hopefully what I offer will encourage the advancement of God in you and through you, and make your time here worthy of the investment. So we should get into this. We've got a lot to cover. But wait, one more crass commercial announcement. Like most American speakers, I too have an album. Why is that? But you know, before I was ever a spoken word message speaker, conference speaker, seminar teacher, I was a singer and a songwriter. And for years, a lot of that has been put on the shelf, but I mean, I've been a worship leader for many, many years, and I've written many songs. But the point is, this latest album is my sixth recording project, and it is on the Parachute label, which makes me very happy, that now it's in international distribution. I had a song off of this on the charts in Australia last year, and I have a song currently getting national radio play in the UK. And that particular song in the UK is about when I have sexual struggles, how does God help me? Interesting that that should be getting airplay. But again, it relates to the fact that when you tell the truth, people respond to that. And so the album called Communicate is really autobiographical. Unlike other works I've done, this is my own retrospect in my 22 years of walking with the Lord of what God has done in my life and how He's made the difference. When I get dirty, how does He make me clean? When I struggle under pressure, how does He help me? And I share about my own history of sexual abuse in the song, What Daddy Did Not Know. I share what it was like to be on the outside looking in when I could never fit in and measure up in the song, One of the Boys. And so these are songs which I think speak to people, and that's why I'm so pleased that about 30% of the people who own this album, they're non-Christian. And I've begun getting those wonderful letters and emails from around the world from people who are being touched by the album. And in seminars, unlike in stores where I have to sell it for $30, here in seminars we can sell it for only $20. So consider that as a good investment, that you can give a quality produced project into somebody's hands who might not be quite ready yet for something more directly worship-oriented or Christian. It's rich in values, and it's my own personal journey, and in the postmodern age, that has real weight to speak into people's lives. So I'm real pleased. And plus, you have to come to my website to get the rest of the lyrics, and there I have a little strategy waiting for people. So I'm really pleased to be able to offer this, and I hope that it will be an encouragement in your efforts to reach others or to be encouraged in your own journey. And there you have it. So it's only $20, and I hope that it will be a blessing. I'm actually getting ready to I'm in the middle, actually, of recording another project, and it's a dance album. And you see, when I moved to New Zealand years ago, I moved here actually to be a lead vocalist with a European industrial band, and we conducted a four-continent world tour, and in that we performed in major nightclubs around the world that are made famous by people like Madonna and Boy George. In fact, in some of the European capital cities, we were just ahead of the Marilyn Manson tour. So it was an interesting clash of cultures, I can assure you. But it was amazing that we would see sometimes, like in one nightclub, particularly in Europe, we saw over 500 people give their lives to the Lord in one nightclub. And so you just can't put God in a box in the way that He might like to bring light into darkness. And for some Christians who felt, oh, is this a compromise? Well, all I can say is I'm glad the Lord Jesus made that particular compromise to leave the safe, sanctified walls of heaven and to come to the dirtiest neighborhood in the universe and bring light, which conquers darkness. Isn't that right? He had to be he had to be willing to be misunderstood by some, and usually just the religious, to be the friend of sinners, to to redeem people. So it's been very worthwhile, my having opportunities here in New Zealand. And when I first came to New Zealand in 1987, right after the Homosexual Law Reform Bill, the church was maybe, shall we say, a little bit cool to what I had to offer. But you know, things change. And I've had a wonderful opportunity throughout New Zealand. And I'm very grateful to the reception that we do have to sow these seeds that God's kingdom can be enlarged. Now, I want to say, too, one last thing, that when I'm up here talking to you, I am not talking to you, telling you what you must do. I'm sharing simply the insights I've learned in my own journey, but not just as a pastoral caregiver for many years, but also as a man who's on the mend coming out of my own broken history, which I've alluded to. But to give you perspective, because that's always very, very useful, this is a picture of me, as I'll be sharing my story tomorrow evening. That's a picture of me when I met the Lord 22 years ago. So when I'm up here talking to you, you may look at me and think, oh, well, it's pretty obvious where he comes from. Maybe not as obvious as you think. That is, I may walk with a limp, but maybe the miracle of God is that I even bother to walk at all, that I enjoy being a man, I enjoy being a husband of 19 years, and I enjoy being a father of a lovely 15-year-old daughter. That does not mean that I'm not a homosexual, because a lot of people live double lives. But the fact is, I live a life remarkably different than anything I ever knew I could achieve. And while that's not proof I'm not gay, it's evidence of growth. And when you grow, things change. And so when I'm up here talking about principles that work in people's lives, it's not just theory. It's not just theology. I've had to practice everything that I'm going to be preaching to you, and I still do. And I will share with you what I've learned works in people's lives, and I will share with you what does not work. Because the church is filled with hype, wishful thinking, and that doesn't work in people's lives. But hopefully the insights I offer will be useful, and when they are applied, will prove productive for people's lives. And that's the best I know to do, to comfort you with the comfort that I have known. And perhaps the greatest comfort is that there's a God in heaven who looked beyond my sin, the perversion that people would have reacted to and judged. He looked beyond it and saw my need. Because after all, people do things for reasons. And that's the basis of God's compassion. It's easy to be right that people are wrong. That doesn't help anybody. What people need to know is there a God who understands me and still values me? And thus, do I have hope in him that there can be a life beyond the way that I'm living? Wouldn't you agree? I think so. So, let's get into it. Turning to your outline, page 1. Right here, on this side of your outline, I want to take a look here at two complaints against pastoral workers. Can I ask here, now I'm not asking for professionals only, but who here is involved in some kind of pastoral care? Excellent. Well, thank you for being here. My point is not to criticize you. I don't want to criticize people who aspire to ministry leadership or who are in it. It can be a pretty thankless task sometimes, and lots of responsibility. The needs are unending. Thanks to Adam and Eve's mistaken choice centuries ago, all of us in pastoral care don't have to worry about the economy. We have guaranteed job security. And so we want to take a look here at two criticisms of pastoral care. Not because we want to be critical only, but I find that through the negative we can learn some wonderful positive information. When people complain against Christian workers, especially when it comes to pastoral care, there's two main complaints that are worth us hearing that we don't continue to repeat them. Complaint number 1 is a lack of redemptive attitude, an unredemptive attitude. When I was based in the States, I used to host TV and radio programs which specialized in sexual themes. And I will never forget when a gentleman telephoned in live on air and he said that he had a weapon to his head. Which, you know, no pressure. And he said he had been a born-again believer going to a spirit-filled church for 22 years. He said that he had same-sex attractions. And he knew, as an evangelical, Bible-believing Christian, that God did not want him to live acting on those feelings. He understood that and accepted and believed it. But that did not make his feelings go away. And he struggled desperately in the church. And he cried out to God regularly, God, take these feelings away from me. Not understanding that God does not take away homosexual feelings. The feelings represent an appetite. You know, when you've got hunger pangs, they may hurt you. You may say, gee, God, take away my hunger pangs. God will not take away an appetite. The only way you get rid of hunger pangs is to satisfy the appetite by eating the right thing. Would you agree? Fortunately, when you're hungry, almost anything can look good, and you can also feed on things that are not right. But the point is, this man didn't understand this, and he cried out to God for God to take away his feelings, and God didn't. He didn't understand why. And he felt that, you know, he was almost abandoned by God, and he decided maybe someone in church could help him, and he decided to take off his carefully polished mask and finally open up and tell the truth about his struggle to someone on pastoral staff. And before he could open his mouth and share, when he finally worked up enough guts to come forward and admit his need, somebody on staff made queer jokes and derogatory comments against gay people. Now, he said, those people on staff talking like that did not know that this man that they saw every week in church standing next to them was a person who had such a problem. You never know who's next to you, do you? You never know who's got an issue like that facing them. And so he was completely demoralized, and maybe he was acting in self-pity, but, you know, 22 years is a long time not to have hope. To hope that it would go away and then it doesn't. To pray your brains out and see no resolve. And so he decided that maybe he would suicide and God would understand. Well, there he was in the living room, in the lounge, in front of the television, and the Lord told him to turn on the TV. And he did, and there he heard me sharing a simple message. I always tell people it's got to be pretty desperate for God to ever tell you to turn on television. And so he was sitting there contemplating suicide. The Lord told him to turn on TV, and he did, and there he heard me sharing a simple message from 1 Corinthians chapter 6. Where Paul wrote to the Corinthian church 2,000 years ago. Why did Paul write that letter? Well, there was immaturity in the church, and there was insecurity in the church, and there was impurity in the church. There had never been a church in Corinth. Corinth was a pagan culture. They had no Jewish influence in their culture, so there wasn't even that foundation. These were totally pagan, godless people, and now salvation had come to them, and there was a new generation of first-time converts who promptly brought all their cultural and human baggage right through the doors of the church. And so they were getting drunk at communion, and they were acting immaturely and insecurely with one another, and there was also sexual sin going on. Because in Corinth, if you could walk down the street and turn somebody on sexually, that was considered a very important cultural quality to possess. They even had a religion which said, if you want blessing on your crops, or you want to atone for sin, you have sex with a temple prostitute. How clever of them to invent that. I'm sure it wasn't the Holy Spirit who inspired it. But at any rate, you can understand why this was a very sexually energized culture. And so they brought their baggage in with them, and Paul had to write to them and say, some of you here, you used to sleep around before you were married. And some of you here, you committed adultery. And some of you here were involved in the sex industry of Corinth. And some of you here were homosexuals, using each other that way or being used that way. And if you persisted in living like that, you would not inherit God's kingdom. But now you're not doing those things anymore because you're not those things anymore because of Jesus. Now, it took me 30 seconds to rattle that off. Did you know that that man said that's more good news than he had ever heard in 22 years of being a Christian struggling homosexually? He had always heard that God hated people like that and that God hated homosexuals and they were doomed to hell. And so here, can you imagine his conflict? And he said, why did I have to wait 22 years to hear a simple biblical illustration that any Bible college graduate should have been able to tell me? And I said, I'm really sorry. But there you have it. Now you know. God redeems sexual strugglers. And we don't know about those Corinthian Christians whether they would persist in having temptations and struggles based on our own human heritage and experience in the recent church. I would say, of course, they will continue to have temptations and struggles. But now we learn that their struggles do not, cause God not to love them. They are still loved by God, who is their advocate, who adopts them into the family of faith, considering their histories and present struggles. But God does cleanse them from their sin, which he called their behavior sinful, and then began to move them beyond the way they used to live. That's good news for us today. That right now, in the 3 to 5 minutes it took me to share this story, many people have not even heard this much. And that's a sad and shameful commentary when you consider God has a rich heritage in Old and New Testaments of redeeming sexual sinners. I'll talk more about that tomorrow. But just look, Rahab the prostitute and Samson and King David and Mary Magdalene and the woman caught in adultery and the woman at the well and the Corinthian church. There are 7 illustrations right there where when you pull them out of the Bible and put them together, give you a flavor of the character of God toward pagans and toward his own people who wrestle with sexuality. And there are redemptive themes in all of them. Many people have never ever read them together to get a better understanding about God. because we tend to moralize and lecture people and try to win an argument that you're wrong and we're right. And the world is very tired of that. Because even the world, though they may look for reasons to justify rebellion, isn't it also true that the world sometimes is an accurate barometer? And they say, don't you dare point a finger at us outside of the family of faith when you, in the family of faith, don't stay out of the moral mud pit yourselves. Whether it's fantasy and masturbation, whether it's addiction to pornography, where 10% of Christian men are estimated to be sexual addicts with online pornography being the snare. You're the ones who molest children, and you're the ones who sexually abuse, and you're the ones who divorce, and you're the ones. Isn't that right? So rather than point a finger at the world, God is saying, the two great commandments are put me first and treat your neighbor like you'd like. Sexual sin interferes with them both. And that's why God, of all the things he's doing around the world, one of the things he is doing in the family of faith is he is putting his finger on this issue among his people. Because how can we comfort the world? Comforting the world does not say, you're wrong and we're right. Comforting people and letting them know that God is love is not holding up placards at the hero parade. That has not won anybody to the kingdom. Would you agree? So it doesn't matter how right we are on a moral level. God says if you judge anybody, judge yourself. You judge others and you will reap judgment. And the church reaps judgment from the world because we would rather be right that they're wrong than win our neighbor. Isn't that generally the truth? And that does not win a neighbor. Also related to this, let me give you a redemptive illustration. One time I was getting ready to share my story in Melbourne. I've been working in Australia for 14 years. And one day I was getting ready to share my story, and gay activists had heard that I was out and about. And so they sent their telefaxes out and their emails. And then, you know, they showed up that evening at the seminar all dressed in black. And anyway, they were with a group called Gays and Lesbians Against Discrimination. And they said, I've come to town to be a neo-Nazi, hate-filled, Bible-bashing bigot. Which, you know, rather hurt my feelings, considering that I grew up being beat up for being gay, and then I go straight, and then I get beat up again. So they were there to protest me, and I didn't know what was going to happen. But I got up, and I said, you know, we've got people from the church here, we've got people from the gay community here, and we've got gays and lesbians against discrimination here. And I said, you know, I know what discrimination feels like. I grew up with discrimination, and I continue to experience it. People look at me with contempt until they realize, oh, I am the conference speaker. And that's the way it is. I have a mirror. I live a public life. I'm very aware that some fish in the sea are green, and some fish in the sea are gray, and some fish are tropical. And so I said, discrimination generally hurts. And you know, if you're a Christian here tonight, and you feel that we owe the gay community an apology because we have not loved our neighbor as ourselves, if you feel that we owe God an apology because we have not made the second commandment our priority, we've made trying to win the moral argument the priority. And if you feel we owe God an apology and the gay community an apology, well then would you stand with me? And the whole church felt sharply convicted, and I led them through a genuine prayer of repentance. And I say genuine because if it had not been genuine, the gay community would have known it. So there you have it. I led them through this prayer. The gay community was amazed. They stayed. They let me share the entire evening without interruption. And after it was over, in fact, it was really quite cool. They stayed for coffee and bickies. And we entered into what might have been called meaningful dialogue. But you know, the real point of the story is, when the pastors who had invited me were saying goodbye to people exiting that day, the two pastors said to the two gay activists, two of the state of Victoria's leading activists who could have turned that night into a nightmare with one edict. Those two gay activists, you know, were encountered by the pastors, and the pastor said, thank you for staying and letting Cy share. And the two activists said, no, we want to thank you because we realized we were wrong. We thought that Cy was here to Bible bash us, and we realized we were mistaken, that even if we don't agree with all of his, you know, outlook and perspective and ideology, we know that you guys are not our enemy. And in the future, when our community has people who have questions of a spiritual nature, we know a church where we can send them, where they will be understood and respected, and we're not going to give you trouble anymore. Now, that's the difference between a redemptive attitude, like the first illustration points, versus an unredemptive attitude. Does that make sense? Hey, Ron, could you maybe take that phone off the hook and kill the telephone? I hate competition. So that's why I always love to tell pastors, don't hope the phone doesn't ring. Take it off the hook. Take control. At any rate, you get the point between those two illustrations. It's pretty clear, isn't it? Redemptive attitude versus unredemptive attitude. We can't afford to have an unredemptive attitude, because what's more important than winning a moral argument in culture is winning people. Jesus, when he came 2,000 years ago, set the precedent. He did not come and rail against pagan Rome. He expected Rome to actually act like non-Christians. He expected pagan Rome to be pagan Rome. But what he began to do was change people's hearts. And it was only a generation later that Rome eventually unwound, both because of its decadence and because of the leavening of the lump of Christianity sweeping through the Roman Empire. Changing hearts is more potent than changing policy. Are you with me? I'm not saying we shouldn't take political action. Do not hear me. I'm saying how we take it needs to be carefully discerned. Now, even if you're here with a good attitude, and I suspect that's true for most of you, I don't need to beat this point to death. But you know what? Even when people love people and care about them and wish to offer redemptive ministry, there's another major problem we've got, and that's ineffective ministry. It's not enough to care about people. Do you know how much abuse has happened in the name of Christian ministry because of ignorance? It's not enough you got a heart that cares for people. There needs to be understanding about these themes now, because there hasn't been for many years. You know, in the 1970s, the Holy Spirit was poured out in modern church history, and there was a charismatic renewal revival that swept around the world, changing the face of many, many churches and denominations and communities. And many people in the church concluded, this is the missing piece. This is the answer. This is what we need and all you need. And then we found out, as we moved on into the 1980s, that then there was the Word of Faith movement, where there was a lot of proclamation of the promises of God and the Word of God. And we thought, no, this is also the missing piece, and this is what we need, and this is the added element that will round it out and make it so we can be successful, overcoming people. And then God promptly had to show us toward the end of the 80s and into the first half of the 90s, no, you're mistaken. Christianity, knowing my word and the empowerment of my spirit, do not make you immune to your humanity. As leader after leader, anointed and appointed leader after leader, Bible college graduates and longtime pastors began morally falling apart left and right in every city, every church, all over the world. Isn't that right? God allowing the church to be humiliated to teach us a very, very understandable lesson, that those things do not make you immune to your humanity. Don't you ever forget it. Isn't that right? And then, in the later half of the 1990s, God began to recalibrate our understanding through the negative. You learn through the negative what you want and what you don't. Touch the hot stove, you'll never be tempted to touch it again. People began to get in touch with the rest of the package, and one of the great movements of the 1990s was the recovery redemption movement sweeping through the church, spilling over into the world, that has become a literal phenomenon around the planet. And that's because we began to recognize that knowing God's word and being empowered by his spirit does not make you immune. But there are principles which, if we apply them and know them first and apply them, being not just hearers of the word, but being doers of what it says to do. When we begin to employ these principles, then though we cannot eliminate our humanity and its risks, we can begin to control that which might have controlled us. We can begin to manage it so that the risks do not sweep us away. And that's what began to happen in the 1990s. In the last days, knowledge shall increase. We think it means technological knowledge, when the real insights being poured out by God around the world are insights into the way God works and into the way he works in fallen humans to bring redemptive principles. These are the things that are being poured out around the world right now. Are you with me? So, we need to have understanding, because we haven't had it. We've been a head full, cognitive, intellectually based Christians. Nothing wrong with knowledge, but the lack of application has not been useful. Now, let's take a look at how sometimes our lack of knowledge can work. For example, a woman comes to church and she's suffering from depression. Here's a typical illustration. When a Christian worker encounters a person suffering from depression like this woman, she goes to a church, the pastor's worldview of her will generally be spiritual and moral. But of course, we all know that we are not just spiritual and moral creatures. We are biological and psychological creatures, absolutely as much as we are spiritual. But when we send the depressed woman to a Christian counselor or Christian worker, their worldview of her will say, well, maybe she's got a demonic stronghold. Or maybe she's not employing one of God's principles, like forgiveness, in an area where there's been hurt. And so no wonder she finds herself trapped in this emotional ditch. And yet we send the very same depressed woman over to the psychiatrist, and by virtue that he's a medically trained doctor, and who understands the psyche and the body, he will look at her, and maybe his first question is not, tell me about your dysfunctional childhood. Maybe instead he will say to her, how much sleep are you getting? Because frankly, you don't get enough sleep. Your serotonin levels, which provide emotional balance, begin to deplete. You don't have enough serotonin. The normal stresses of life become overwhelming and unable to be managed properly. And then you fall into the ditch of depression relatively easily without having to have a demon or a dysfunctional childhood. Bad body management is one of the major contributors toward depression. That's why they are discovering with new research that better than drug treatment is getting some sleep, better diet, and exercise. Physical activity is doing marvelous works in helping people climb out of the ditch of depression. And all because there was a lack of body management. Then you send the same person over to a social worker. And the social worker says, well, child, no wonder you're struggling with depression and you've fallen into a ditch of hopelessness. You're overwhelmed. Your husband's gone off and left you with five children. You're trying to burn the candle at both ends, holding two jobs to pay the bills. You have no hope. You're overwhelmed. We'll get you some support. We'll lift the burden and put you back on a road where these things are not yours only to manage. And you'll see some light at the end of the tunnel. Now, you know what? In this one depressed woman's example, all three of these worldviews may be correct. And there's where if we only send her to the pastor, she may only get a third of her ministry. And that's why we need to take advantage of our community resources and realize that we don't have to bear this terribly false burden that Christians know all the answers. That's the dilemma for many pastors, when the fact is we don't know all the answers. Even Jesus said people of the world can have more light than God's own people. So take advantage of your community resources and do the part that you can as a pastor. Part of being a pastor doesn't mean having to have all the answers. But I think that many of us labor under this burden, that if I know God and God knows everything, then therefore God would tell me everything to help this person. And God has never suggested this in His Word. Would you agree? So we do what we can, walking in the light that God's given, and then we look to see what other resources may serve, because the goal is not to have the answers. The goal is to help the person. Okay? Here's another illustration. The demonized person. Now, I do believe in demonic forces, and I'm sure you do too. And when a person, have you ever heard this? Someone who has struggled with demonic infection, they come forward for ministry and they get it. They get powerful ministry where they feel released, they feel relief, and they say, wow, I feel better than I've ever felt. Wow, I just feel so free. Have you heard this kind of a testimony? And then, have you ever heard 2 months later, 2 years later, same person will say, I don't understand what's wrong. I thought I was set free. And now I'm struggling all over again, it seems, back at square one with the very same problem. Sound familiar? Well, let me tell you. Here's what I've observed in my years of work in this, where many of my clients do have elements of demonization or infection from demons. And that is, if I'm working in a dirty field out there, the manure-filled field, and I'm out there way far away from the farmhouse, and then I get a cut, I can't run back to the house and get it taken care of. So I take an old dirty rag and I bandage it up and go about my business. What I did not know was that I've just introduced, through that injury, that opening, alien hostile life forces that look for an opening in the host, whereby if they are not neutralized by being taken captive, they begin to replicate and multiply and become a colony of influence. I can't think of a better description of demonic behavior. Can't see it, taste it, touch it, smell it. But when there is a natural opening or an injury, they gain access, and if not taken captive, they begin to multiply to take you captive. And that's why the biblical definition of demonic activity is not oppression, outward pressure, or possession, inward influence. The actual biblical word is demonization, which is like the concept of infection. Infections are sometimes localized around a splinter, or they are totally systemic, like strep throat. Would you agree? Anyway, a few weeks pass, and what had been just a tiny cut here now has become a breeding ground for infection. I didn't take care of it in my business, didn't want to go to the doctor in my busyness, wanted to take care of it myself, but now I've got a boil, and I've got septicemia, and it's spreading down my arm, and my function is crippled, and though the rest of my body may be healthy, this area gets all the attention, and my movement is crippled due to the swelling and the pressure, and I'm in pain, and I go to the doctor, and I say, and the doctor says, poor baby, we'll fix it, and he lances it, and he washes out the pus, and what do I feel initially? Relief, freedom of movement, release. Oh, much better, I say, and then I walk out the door. Now, if the doctor hasn't closed up the injury, if he hasn't put a plaster and sutured it shut, if he hasn't given me antibiotic treatment, what's going to happen? I'm almost doomed for reinfection. How many times have we, in the name of Jesus, had in the authority of Jesus the ability to wash out a demonic infection? That's not the problem. We haven't shut the door that enabled the infection underlying the infection, which is the real source of the problem. Demonic infection is the secondary issue. It's why the demons gain the stronghold that is often not addressed. And what we've offered with good intent but a lack of understanding is ineffective ministry. We may have washed the wound, we didn't shut it. And even Jesus said when it comes to demonic influence, you can tie up the strong man. But doesn't he talk about the house that's been, you know, the dirty house that you can sweep the dirt out the door, but the house can be dirty again. Why? Well, Jewish people who were used to sweeping dirt outdoors understood you can sweep the dirt out the door, but if you don't shut the door, the dirt comes back. Is that right? And so even this lack of understanding with many demonized people has caused us to offer half a ministry, and though with good intent, we have been ineffective. Just in one thing, because of a lack of understanding. Do I make sense? Friend of mine, Jan Frank, her books are listed. She specializes in sexual abuse and incestuous abuse. She's a clinical therapist in Los Angeles who had a history of sexual violation beginning at the age of 12 from her stepfather. Jan, as a therapist, she says she's found in churches, in the academic intelligentsia churches, they don't believe in the demonic, and so they try to bring healing emotionally and cognitively to people's woundedness and strongholds. And then the charismatic churches, which may be a little less cognitive and maybe more experiential and power-based, they try to bring deliverance, you know, to people's injuries. She says, the problem is you do not heal people intellectually of demonic influence in the intellectually based churches. And in the experiential power-based churches, you don't bring healing or you don't deliver people from woundedness. You can't deliver a wound. And you can't heal a bondage. You deliver a bondage and you heal a wound. And even that swap, that lack of understanding on either side of that camp, has also, again, produced ineffective ministry because of a lack of understanding. So my goal today is to provide understanding. Do I make sense so far? As we begin to warm up our brains here for this Saturday morning marathon, and you don't know how much marathon it will be. I assure you it will be. Now, I also want to say that a problem in the church is that many pastors themselves are also not invulnerable. And so we naturally want to have discussion here for just a moment about the issue of your own integrity. And if you look down there on the sheet of paper, we've got some statements I want you to fill in. Because there are many pastoral workers who get infected, who get into trouble. They struggle with lust, fantasy, masturbation, and boundary crossing. And a major news magazine, I believe it was Bulletin or Newsweek magazine, on their cover story, showed a man and a woman in bed. And the headline of the cover story was about care workers, people helpers, who cross the line into inappropriate relationship with those they serve. And the survey asked them, and the survey was done of doctors and lawyers and nurses and professional therapists and clergy, pastoral workers. And in the survey, 87% admitted being sexually attracted to someone in their care. Now, really, if they'd been honest, it would have been 100%. And we shouldn't be shocked because we're all just people. And human beings have the capacity to be attracted across the boundaries. That's why we have boundaries. Because in spite of feelings, I make right choices. It doesn't matter whether I have feelings or not. I make right choices in spite of how I feel. That's part of maturity. Isn't that right? You know, that's what when you get rid of all the sentiment around wedding vows, that's what they are really. The wedding vows are actually boundary setting. You're saying that it's easy to marry someone you feel love for. Feelings change. The fact is, you're going to continue to love the one you marry based on the way that you treat them and act. And the fact is, the world is filled with opportunities, availabilities, and attractions. So what? That's part of the risk of being a human. But the fact is, in spite of those things, I make right choices. But see, what many people think is, oh, I'm in love now, and therefore could never have the capacity to be attracted to somebody beyond the boundary. And that is about 10 minutes worth of wisdom. You know, it's people, I always say, oh, you've only been married for 2 months then. So, And everybody who's been married more than 2 months knows what I mean. So in this survey, they asked, you know, have you ever been attracted to somebody in your care? 87% admitted, well, of course. And yet, that's not the shocker. The shocker is 48% admitted going all the way and having sex. 48%, you know, like one out of two? The risk for pastoral workers is 13 percentage points higher than for non-Christians. Now, part of that might be because of satanic strategies. Part of it is, I would say, in the church, is because we don't talk about these things. And pastors graduate from Bible college with a head full of theology and morality and not the skills of how to manage their own risks, let alone help somebody else. You can tell somebody all day long adultery is wrong, the Bible says. That's not the same as helping them. That's not the same as managing your own integrity. Would you agree? And so when the Bible says, in your efforts to help others, don't become entangled in sin with them, understanding how Jewish people wrote years ago, the understanding is, with implication, of course you can be entangled in sin with them. It's no different than if you're a nurse working in the infectious disease ward versus a general ward. When you work on the general floor as a nurse, well then you take some hygienic precautions, of course. But when you're working in the infectious disease ward, just because you're healthy, the fact that you associate with people who have communicable diseases means you make all the extra efforts necessary to minimize the risks, which you cannot totally escape. So you gown up and glove up and mask up and then you scrub up, having had contamination with the unclean thing. Is that right? And if it's true for your body, how much truer is it for the soul? And what I just said in 30 seconds, that much insight is often not conveyed to pastoral workers when they graduate from Bible college and they walk out there into a world of risk, completely unprepared to manage it, and that's why every year thousands of God's workers fail and fall. Not because they're bad, it's because they're human. And human means vulnerable, at risk. Would you agree? So with this in mind, first of all, know your limits and do not pretend to be a therapist if you are not one. No shame in not having all the answers. All you can do is the best you can to encourage people. And part of good pastoral care is saying, you know, I don't have all the answers, but I care about you. Let me pray for you now. You come and report to me next week, but I want you to go to see this therapist that I've found out about in our community, and I trust their counsel, and I have checked them out to make sure that they will support your values. I want you to see them. That is good pastoral care. Secondly, know your community's resources. Know whom you can trust. When I opened up ministry doors in Singapore, where they had never had a support group before I ever opened the doors to our organization, I found out who were the other Christian counselors in town, what is their worldview and beliefs about sexual themes and redemption of them, and then I found out who are the non-Christian therapists and would they still be worth knowing and employing, because sometimes a Christian therapist might not be specializing in an area that my client might need. I wanted to find out who's out there and what other resources are out there so that I alone don't have to have the burden of knowing everything and helping everybody. Offer realistic expectations, which we will take a look at today, because the church is filled with hype. Oh, just come to Jesus. He'll fix it all. And of course, again, you only have to be born again 10 minutes to know that's not true. Christianity is not a lifestyle improvement course. Christianity does not promise to solve our problems. Isn't that right? But people are coming to Christ often with a false bill of goods sold to them with mistaken expectations that just say this sinner's prayer and God will zap you. You'll be a new creation. 2 Corinthians 5:17, if any man is in Christ, behold, he becomes a new creation. The old life passes away and all things become new. And there are many in the family of faith who labor under a false burden because of a misinterpretation due to wishful thinking in Pentecostal circles particularly of this verse. And this verse in the original Greek language tense of verb called the perfect Greek tense, it says this: if you're in Christ, a transformation process has been initiated and it will continue to transform you. That's very different from the mistaken concept conveyed to people that says if you're in Jesus, every aspect of your broken, fallen humanity has been completely transformed as if it had never been fallen before. The implication being, therefore, if you wrestle with things related to your past, there's something wrong with you and your faith. We know what's wrong is this verse has been misrepresented. Do you follow me? If you were in Jesus, a transformation process has been initiated in you with the advent of salvation, and it will continue unfolding as you walk with God. That's the idea conveyed by this verse and its grammar. Isn't that a little more realistic? Isn't that a little more attainable and hope-inspiring? Otherwise, why would we need perseverance? How many people are laboring falsely just because of this one verse being misrepresented? 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 17. Then, guard your own integrity, as I mentioned. You will be tested. You will be attracted. And let me give you a practical illustration of how I do this. Wow, man. These are the best whiteboard markers I ever saw in my life. Cool. Oh, gee, I like that. Anyway, whenever I am dealing with counseling for, and I don't do counseling now, I have for many years, and when I say counseling, I don't mean professional therapy, but pastoral care. And whenever I would offer that, as I did for many, many years, I must say, I was not offering financial management counseling, general pastoral care. I was offering specific help for sexual strugglers. The differences between general nursing versus infectious disease ward, I had to take extra precautions. I come from a broken background, working with broken people. We're not talking about interior decor or how to raise your teenage child. We're talking about powerful, swelling, swirling emotions, demonic influences, and vulnerabilities on either side of the client-counselor divide. Therefore, taking extra efforts to protect my credibility and client, here's what I did. Me in a healthy way. Are you with me? Likewise, most of my clients, 80% of my clients, have histories of sexual violation. That is boundary violation. And 90% of them have not had good connection with parents or peer group. They are emotionally, relationally starving. They are prematurely sexualized and boundary violated. Now that means that when they come into my office, they do not know how to connect and perceive connecting appropriately. Doesn't mean that they're dumb. They may be quite intellectually capable. It means that on the relational level, they don't know how to connect effectively. And that sets them up to misinterpret my interests and their own attachment to me. So if I'm warm and caring and available, their first perception of that may be sexual. If they find me accepting and available and interested in them, their only way of interpreting that may be sexual. And so we usually get through that. But what I'm saying is to make it safer for everybody and more relaxed and easier in light of these realities, here's what I do. I put a table between me and the client. You know what that says? Boundary. Not too big a boundary. I can reach across it and hold hands. But it says, in your life that has been marked by boundarylessness, we will not move too close too quick. There's a barrier here that needs to exist, that should have existed, and I will have it there for you. You know what that does for them? It makes them relax. Because while in some counseling it may be true that we need not have a boundary like that of a physical sense, but there was a lot of teaching in the 70s and 80s that said we want to be warm and close without a big pretentious desk. Well, this is not a big pretentious desk. This is a simple table, but it is a symbolic physical statement that says we have a boundary here, not too close too quick, because my clients have problems connecting too close too quick. Are you with me? And then there would be me, and then there would be my client. And then there would be a third person, my apprentice counselor. Because God never said counseling had to be only one-on-one. So my second major point, first point is have a boundary. Secondly, have an associate. You know, two people are not a community. Three people, as the Trinity makes clear, is the formation of one, the foundation of one. Most of my clients are wounded in a community. They are wounded in the family of origin, which is a community. They are starved in the family of origin. Or they are rejected by their peer group. That is a community. And most of my clients, therefore, will get better in a community, not in one-on-one counseling. I'll explain more about that later. Am I making sense so far? And so what happens here? What are the benefits of having an associate? Well, I get to apprentice, train. That means I get to multiply. I get to multiply my ministry. That is, if I'm away, I've got an informed party there. they don't have to reinvent the wheel. If the client has a crisis, there's already someone they can talk to. And at the same time, I don't have to be the only guru with the insights. God speaks through another person, maybe to illumine a point that would not have come to my mind by virtue they're a different person. And in multiplying the ministry, I'm raising up someone who gets firsthand experience in working in an area of troublesome ministry and pastoral care. I'm getting to multiply the ministry and pass on insights and learning and experience. Additionally, I get protection. If I find myself attracted to the client, it's not going to go anywhere. It's going to last 10 minutes and be extinguished. It's not going to go anywhere. I don't even have to consciously think it, really, because by virtue of this person being there, the boundary is set. There's a witness. This causes my client to relax. You'd be amazed at how many people have come forward for pastoral care and they've been hit on sexually by a caregiver. The last thing I want my client to worry about is that that is ever going to be a possibility. And my clients feel protected when they've got a witness. Likewise, if my client is disgruntled with me and wants to say something mean and nasty, not going to go anywhere. I've got a witness and I'm protected. Sometimes our clients are angry and very immature people. And when you begin to see issues surface, when their anger or when their blame toward others surfaces, it may get projected on you. No matter how wonderful you may become the target. And therefore, I have a witness. Generally, in the first four or five sessions, depending on their experience, obviously, they might be quieter as an observer. But I always want them to feel the freedom to comment, and then if I feel it's too much or whatever, I set boundaries. I don't have a problem setting boundaries. But I think that, you know, I'm bringing in here someone I already reasonably trust and have a degree of relationship with. It's not just any old body. Now, I don't have a problem with it being a husband-wife team, for example, provided that they do flow together well, that they are, you know, capable as a team. Also, if I'm dealing with a female client, I will try to have a female available. It would be the very rare exception. And she would have to be very comfortable if I had an additional male, because many of our women have boundary violations at the hands of men, and that might be a dynamic that would make her uncomfortable. So I try to make sure that we have a second, you know, female in the room. Then also, if I'm dealing with a male client, then, you know, they don't have, in about 60% of the cases I find, they don't have a problem with a female associate. But now in about 40% of the cases, they do not want a woman in the room. They want another male. And so, you know, this is where we need to work to find people that would be available that way. So also in terms of protection, I want to say that there is a counseling dynamic called transference. And that's where sometimes the client who is starving for love will, you know, project onto you and make you a romantic ideal. This is a temporary phase. It's kind of like a crush. It's saying, really, in so many words, I need to be noticed and feel good about myself, and the fact that you notice me and accept me does make me feel good. And they respond out of emotional need real strongly. And there's where we have to be really careful to be well set in our boundaries and have integrity, that they don't ever misinterpret our interest in them. And we don't have to be afraid. We can, you know, but there's where having another person in the room keeps it safer. You follow me? And that's why I do it this way. Because we're not just offering generic run-of-the-mill counsel. Now, you might think, well, gosh, would this person ever open up and share if there's another person available? Well, you know, if you're going to ever be my client, it will be on my terms. You don't tell me how I'm available to you. I will tell you how I'm available for you. Because I don't have just you and your ego and your concerns to think about. I have to monitor the credibility of my service to the Lord and my family, my own human brokenness and limitation. It's not just about making you comfortable. It's doing what's ethically correct for you and me. Does that make sense? So I don't let the client tell me how I'm going to serve them. This is the way I'm available. You don't like it, you can go somewhere else. I don't mean that to be harsh, but I'm not going to compromise on this. Do I make sense? Okay. And you know what? Like once in 15 years have I ever had a complaint. So it goes to show you that that only lasts a brief time, that uncomfortableness. Now, question? Is that making sense? Okay. Moving on then. Let's take a look now at the outline. Right here, part 5 on this list, this side of the list. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Pardon?
How
I'm Sai, and I'm serving you today. What's your name?
Good.
So we're already into it. No, it's all right. Better late than not. You're not that late either. So we're at a good point, though, to go ahead and begin. Do you have an outline? Okay. Well, hopefully, this will be an encouraging day and make a lot of sense. Okay, well, I'm going to erase this and get into this next section. We will have a break here this morning following this section. They don't call me the bladder buster for nothing. So bear up, you know, if it's hard to sit there and try to be coherent, imagine me having to talk and be coherent. But as I always say, we'll suffer together. It'll be good. We'll bond. Now, part one, five categories of sexual problem in the church. We want to take a look. There are 17 sexual problems humans can develop thanks to Adam and Eve's choice. And I will not put all 17 of those up there for you, but we will lump them basically into five categories that if you are in pastoral care, you will encounter these in the first 10 minutes probably, or that is, the first 2 years, you'll encounter especially point number one. And that's what I call the common concerns. Let's see here. The common concerns. Number one, we know adultery is pretty straightforward and a problem that happens in the family of faith. I want to say for those who struggle and who have crossed the marriage boundaries, that I know many marriages where they have broken up because of adultery. But I also know marriages where adultery has occurred where they have brought, you know, where the Lord has brought healing into the relationship and has mended the relationship. And so I always like to say that while there is no obligation for the marriage to mend, at the same time, if both parties are willing, there can be a mending of the marriage relationship, and I think we all are aware of that, but there are more resources available today than ever before, people's testimonies, where they have found their marriages mend. Another problem in the family of faith is the issue of premarital sex. And of course, when I think of premarital sex, we think of actual sexual intercourse. But that's not what I'm talking about. We know that intercourse before marriage is a problem in the family of faith. In fact, according to research of Western Christian teenagers are just about as sexually active as non-Christians. Now, this is not because they lack intellectual knowledge. When you're a Christian and you go to church and you go to youth group, you get the sex sermons preached to you. So you know what the moral boundaries are, which goes to show you that cognitive information does not rescue you from your humanity. So our churches are filled with Christian teenagers who know what the boundaries are. But here's the point. The point is, many Christian teenagers get involved in sex before marriage, and here's why. There are two big assumptions that are a problem for them. Assumption number one is, as long as we're not having actual intercourse, it's okay. And of course, I like to challenge Christian teenagers, oh, who told you that? You know, as long as we can do touchy-touchy, feely-feely, making a good pass, you know, we can have a good time, as long as it's not intercourse, then it's okay. And I have to say, who told you that? Probably not the Holy Spirit. Probably pagan culture under the lordship of Satan, who would want you to have your boundaries as violated as possible because it will produce complexities later when you try to walk with God. The other second assumption is that that's what normal guys and girls are supposed to do on a date, isn't it? Said who? And so what we're doing in a lot of our churches, we're not teaching our kids why God puts boundaries. If God says don't do it, why? Now, my worldview, based on Old Testament and New Testament scriptures, is sex. When you have sex with somebody, you have married them. A marriage ceremony does not marry you from the biblical model. Sex act is the pact. When you have sex with somebody, then you have married them. And this is why people are haunted and problemed years after abandoning sexually sinful relationships or relationships out of classic marriage. They're haunted by what's called the echo effect, because they've married, they've given their body to someone, and if they don't know how to cut that soul tie, they will struggle with an open door in their soul to past connections. Are you with me? So consequently, you know, even the Lord Jesus said, the only grounds for adultery, I mean, the only grounds for divorce is adultery. He said, now, you know, the New Testament teachings on separation are, if you can't live in peace, then separate. But you're still considered married unless there's been a violation of the pact through adultery. Are you with me? You don't have to agree with me. And I'm not saying if you've divorced here, you're bad and God's mad at you. Do not hear me. I am not saying that. But I'm saying the standard that you see set in the New Testament is, if your husband beats you, you don't have to stay with him. For heaven's sake, get out if you can. But the point is, you are still considered under the pact until there has been adultery. Because it's when you join your bodies that that is the act of marriage. And even thousands of years down the road, since Old Testament scriptures were written about this, the Catholic Church practices this fact that you can have a 20-minute wedding ceremony, and that's all good in describing a social intent that you're going to be sexual exclusively with this person. But the marriage is not a marriage if it has not been consummated sexually. Then it was just a ceremony that can be annulled. That's based on a biblical concept that even the Old Testament says, young man, when you find a woman desirable and you just can't resist her and she yields to you and you have sex with her, marry her. You are married in God's eyes, or else you will be executed. Now, God took it rather seriously. And you know what was the job of the best man at a wedding? Where do we get that tradition? From the ancient Aramaic celebration and practice that he's the one who told all the wedding guests, they're doing it now. They're having sex now, and that's when the party, the wedding celebration, would begin, because they understood that that is the pact, that act. Are you with me? And so consequently, when you have sex, research by insurance companies, of all people who wish to know their population groups and the risks associated with them, they understand that when you have sex a lot with people, or with a lot of people, your risk of divorce is 60% higher than for people who are virgin at marriage. That's because you open your doorway. You open your heart through relational connection, which brings complexity into ongoing relationships if you've had many others before. Are you with me? So having said it, when I talk about premarital sex, I am not just talking about intercourse, petting. Now, you know, a good pash. A lot of kids think it's okay to do that because it's not real intercourse, when actually they're mistaken. We would define a good pash as physically intimate sexual contact, the purpose of which is to stir up sexual desire. Agreed? But you know what the problem with that is? That's not called a pash. That's called foreplay. Foreplay is the first third of intercourse. It is the first part to prepare you for intercourse. So what we actually have is tons of Christian teenagers practicing foreplay with each other. And it's no wonder they go all the way. Because when you turn that car engine on, you were designed to want to drive all the way home. So the point is, if you're not married to this person, then why are you playing around and touchy-touchy, feely-feely with something that is not yet yours? You sample the goods from the biblical model, they become your goods. And that's why a pash is not a pash. It is foreplay. And there's where young people, whenever they say, well, how far can I go on a date then? If I'm single and I want a date, how far can I go? I tell them what the boundary is. Being the father of a lovely 15-year-old daughter, I'll tell you what the boundary is. The boundary is that if you can't do it in front of your mom and dad, you probably shouldn't be doing it. And if you think that sounds strange to your ears, that tells me who you're listening to. You are living still under the assumptions sown into you by pagan fallen culture that it's normal and my right or privilege to get to do this on a date as long as it's not intercourse. And I would say, who are you listening to if this sounds strange to you? Because if you haven't taken the responsibility of marriage, in my opinion, and it's my seminar, if you haven't taken the responsibility of marriage, you are not entitled to the reward. There is never regret in saying, we won't cross those boundaries. There's almost always regret with people when you do. Would you agree? So we got to teach our young people boundaries. Now, I was a sexually promiscuous, boundary-violated person. I am not here talking to anybody to make them feel bad. I am saying this is the truth that will protect people. I wish I had known it. Does that make sense? Then, another problem in our churches. This is point number one, the common problems. These are typical problems. Adultery, premarital sex, and same-sex attractions. Now, homosexuality isn't just homosexuality. There, according to Baker's Encyclopedia of Psychology, in the chapter Classification, Etiology, and Treatment, there are 10 clinical classifications of homosexuality. I'm going to give you three of them because these are the three most typical that you need to understand the distinctions, because if you want to care for people and if you do struggle here in some way or listening to me via tape, you need to understand that these three common areas of problem need to be understood because pastoral care is different for each category. Now, category number one is what is called the situational homosexual. For example, boarding school, military, prison. Many of the people in those environments, they are heterosexual. But by virtue of the environment and the situations in it, they may cross the line and be homosexual. I had experiences with men who were not homosexual, but they were looking for recreational sex, and they took advantage of my homosexuality. They did not think of themselves as gay, and out of that situation, they went on and lived heterosexually. Typically true in prison, typically true in boarding school, typically true in the military. Now, for example, in a boarding school, a young man, he's 17, seventh form, he's going to go to university next year. He's been masturbating, looking at pornography for a number of years, beginning about the age of 14. His sex appetite is cultivated. He doesn't have Christ in his life, so he doesn't have even the boundaries there to hold him back. And like many of the world, he becomes sexually involved. But the only people available to him in the school are other boys, and so he goes after the 13-year-old young man. That 13-year-old is not a homosexual either. But the 17-year-old uses him. And then once the 17-year-old graduates and he's out of school, it's like water off a duck's back. He doesn't think of himself as gay. He isn't gay. It might have been technical homosexuality, but for him it was just a recreational sexual outlet. Are you with me? And he goes back out there into the world and, you know, he goes on. And he doesn't have any more homosexual episodes because he isn't homosexually oriented. He was just looking for recreational outlet. But this 13-year-old young boy, though he's not gay, the way he perceives the event becomes a crisis in his identity. Why was I the one sought out, will be the question in his soul. What made me different to be the target? And then what he often does is he will try to find out if indeed he is gay, because now this has been brought to question. So he will repeat homosexual experiences to see if indeed he liked the next time he did it. And when he had an orgasm, because orgasms feel good. Orgasms are chemical experiences in your brain and private parts which have no moral basis. When you have an orgasm, the body doesn't care why you had it or under what circumstances you had it. All the brain chemistry will say is, that felt good. Do it again. It doesn't care about the other implications. Because when you have an orgasm, powerful chemicals are released in your brain equal to the impact of morphine and opium. And they create what's called a marker of association. That felt good. That dramatic, pleasurable moment. I don't care if it happened under homosexual circumstances or not. It felt good. Do it again. And then the more you do it, the more you repeat it. The more you repeat it, the more you reinforce it. The more you reinforce it, you dig a neurochemical ditch that you might not climb out of. And that young man, though he was not gay, not born gay, not having other circumstances to make him gay, he experiences in psychology what is called the narrowing effect. He keeps repeating these homosexual episodes triggered by the 17-year-old. And though he could have been straight, he has now only cultivated an exclusive homosexual appetite by virtue of his situational experience. Are you with me? And ministering to someone like that, I've met with men who hate gay people, big macho blokes, man, and I've watched him at the altar break, weep, and sob because they were hit on when they were kids. And they've carried a terrible shadow and baggage with them for years. Am I gay? I don't know. I did it. It felt good. What does that mean about me? Because of what others did to them in the situation. And knowing how to liberate them from that terrible fear and that baggage, that shadow they've carried for years, is important to understand where it came from and how it affects them. Are you with me? Second category that we work with of homosexually oriented people is the obligatory. Obligatory. You know, we get the word obliged, obligated. That means bound and committed to. What does it mean? When you think of a gay person, this is probably who you're thinking of. The man or the woman who views themselves as gay, they are emotionally, sexually, romantically attracted to the same sex, and they will surround themselves with other people that will reinforce this as a good thing and provide opportunity for that need or desire to be satisfied. This is the obligatory. And why is it called obligatory? Well, because in classic literature about people in this category, most of them report, this is not my opinion of them, this is what they have reported to professionals, most of them come from backgrounds where they did not have proper attachment to the parent of the same sex. And they did not effectively attach and identify with their peer group. Now, this is not my opinion. These are their statements. And my point here is, we are not here to blame parents, please. If you're a parent of an adult homosexual and you think this is my fault, I am not saying that here. It's one thing for mom and dad to send a signal of love to their child. It's another thing for a fallen child to pick up on the signal and perceive it. Are you with me? Sometimes parents do fail their children, and there are repercussions, to be sure. But I find that most parents just do the best they know how. And they love their children. But children themselves are autonomous and fallen. And even if you send a pretty strong signal, there's no obligation, or I should say, there's no absolute that your child will get the signal. At any rate, according to research, most people in this category, they have an identity crisis. Their appetite to connect and be identified with the same sex has not been satisfied. Their appetite to connect and identify with the same sex has not been satisfied, and therefore they are driven, obligated to find compensation. And unfortunately, the way that they often compensate is through sexual union, because also many of our clients in this category have histories of sexual violation. So many of them connect sexually. When they are not interested in sex, they are emotionally hungry. And they use sex as the vehicle to connect. Are you with me? And that's why in homosexual subculture, they are often highly promiscuous. For example, according to research in the 1990s of Western gay people, 83% of heterosexuals, non-Christians, 83% of heterosexuals in Western culture are actually monogamous. Only 4% of homosexuals are. That's an enormous disparity. That though propaganda says we're just like straight people. Not necessarily. Because behaviorally and medically, we have the statistics now which tell the fuller story. And so if you want more research done, you can read more research that has been done. You can get the book Homosexuality and the Politics of Truth by a Harvard psychologist, Dr. Jeffrey Satinover. It's on your reading list. So the obligatory homosexual, I was one of these, needs to be understood that they are starving for connection and identification. They are hungry and therefore driven. And when I came to Christ, Christ did not take away my appetite. He gave me a new platform with which to satisfy it. Out of my connection with Him, the ultimate male, and out of my connection to other males in the family of faith, I had been starved for same-sex love. The only kind of love I got from men, they went to bed with me. Men either beat me up or went to bed with me. And when I began to connect in the family of faith with men who treated their neighbor like they'd like to be treated, men who spent time with me and hugged me and touched me and who were involved in my life, then they began to fill up my starved appetite. And when you're no longer hungry, then a lot of the things that used to have power and appeal, you know, it's like when you're fasting going grocery shopping versus when you've just eaten a really big meal. You know, you buy just about anything in the store when you're fasting. Everything suddenly looks good. But then whenever you're really well fed, then you're almost invulnerable to all the possibilities. Isn't that right? And this is a very good piece of insight from a 4,000-year-old psychological piece of philosophy. Proverbs chapter 27, verse 7 says it so well. To a man who has just eaten a big meal, honey is no longer desirable. But to a man who is starving, even something bitter tastes sweet. In psychological terms, it is reinterpreted according to research of Western teenagers. This research reveals that if you grow up in a home where you feel loved, even if your parents weren't perfect, even if you're poor or uneducated, doesn't matter. If you grow up in a home where you feel loved, then sexual temptation, it will come along, but it will lose its power to trap you. But if you grow up in a home where you don't feel loved, it doesn't matter how well educated you are and how well dressed you are. Material possessions don't make you feel loved. Neither does an education. The only thing that makes you feel loved is effective relationship bonds over time. And if you grow up in a home where you didn't get those kinds of relationship bonds, then you, according to research, Western teenagers almost always turn to sexual intimacy as a substitute for non-sexual intimacy. In other words, C.S. Lewis says it also very well. Human appetite will not tolerate to be ignored. You will satisfy it rightly or wrongly. The appetite doesn't go away. Therefore, understanding that we have hunger and it will be satisfied, and rules don't make you feel loved, religious ritual and activity won't hurt you, but it will not make you feel loved. The only thing that makes you feel loved is effective relationship tie. Does that make sense? And that's why the family of faith has to be more than just a community of people who agree on certain forms of worship and ideology, who get together for an hour or two in a week. That is not a community. And that's why you can read the Bible, pray and fast, and have a head full of all the right things, and be starving to death still. Because it's relationships that save you. And that's why all of our faith is built upon two relationship foundations. Put God first as the source in relationship, and when He is the anchor, then you won't be crossing other people's boundaries and looking to them as your source. And secondly, treat your neighbor like you'd like to be treated. That is, don't use your neighbor to meet your needs as a means to an end. Don't walk into the church with a shopping list of expectations where those people have to meet my needs. You go and serve others, and as you give, you shall get. That's why the antidote to sexual sin is relational, because sexual sin is about relationship sin. Are you with me? Then the third kind of homosexual we work with, I did not make up this name, do not blame me, is neurotic regressive. Now, when I was based in Orlando, Florida for many years, heading up an organization of pastoral care for sexual problems, 30% of my Christian male clients, 30% of my Christian male clients were married, living double lives in homosexual behavior. These men did not think of themselves as gay, and they were not in this sense. They did not want a lover. They did not want a gay lifestyle. They did not think of themselves as gay. And yet most of them were married and fathers, obviously able to function heterosexually. But the name here actually describes what's going on in the lives of these men. The word neurotic means there's an area of emotional damage which creates a pattern that will repeat. That's what it means. A pattern of damage that repeats. And then the regressive means, under pressure, these men will regress back to an adolescent season when they will bond with the same sex. Are you with me? Now, putting this together, it means there are men in the church, every year they get arrested or they get into trouble with their wives because they are involved in sexual episodes outside the marriage. They are arrested and shamed, and it's like, oh, how could this pastor do this? He's married with 5 children. How could he be involved in homosexual connections with men? He's not gay in this sense. He's this kind. He is married and a father, and he enjoys heterosexual sex. But there's a damage zone in his life that when under the pressures of being a Christian worker, husband, father, the stresses of trying to make it and live up to expectations, he can't cope because there's damage in his soul. And under pressure, that triggers him every so many weeks to act in an adolescent way, connecting in a sexual way with other men. Now, when you get rid of your, ooh, that's disgusting, you get over that reaction, you recognize people do things for reasons. These are intelligent, moral people who are making these terribly wrong choices, putting themselves at risk, their marriages at risk, their health at risk. So why would intelligent people who know better do this? The damage triggers a reaction. They feel inadequate very often. They feel inferior very often. And in an attempt to feel good about themselves and regain a sense of control when they feel powerless, they will act out in a sexual way. And when you get rid of sex from what's going on and see it as a symbolic act, like a report card where their soul is at, then you begin to see what they're doing. In other words, when a man uses a man, you know what he's actually saying? I want power, and I feel powerless. And when I use you, that makes me feel in control and powerful in a world that challenges me. Does that make sense? Likewise, when a man is used homosexually, it's actually what is called in psychology incorporation. I will incorporate into myself what is missing. I will borrow your more potent manhood because my own manhood feels so lacking. So when I bond with you, it is an attempt to complete what is missing. Are you with me? So people do things for reasons. It doesn't make it right. It makes it understandable. It makes it forgivable. It makes it correctable. When we stop reacting morally and see that people do things for reasons that can be understood and attended to. Are you with me? And so these are people who often cultivate almost addictive-like patterns, and this is where they need understanding and accountability, that there are answers, there are solutions. It doesn't have to go on. But that accountability means taking off a mask and no longer keeping a secret with Satan. It means getting some assistance, because God never said you had to overcome your problems all by yourself to get better. Do I make sense? What often happens is these men are scared to death to tell the truth, but they end up getting caught. Because you know what? When you're in a marriage, especially, God loves your wife as much as you. And God will allow you a time and a season to tell the truth, or then God will let you be caught. Not because he's mad, not because he hates you, not because you're bad, because this is destructive and it needs to stop. And so you tell or God tells. You get help or God will see to it you get help. Because Jesus wants to be Lord in this area. He doesn't want this secret zone of sin competing with his lordship. And when you look at the eternal picture, a little bit of embarrassment, shame, difficulty, struggle, and turbulence now, it may be painful, but it can bear wonderful fruit and freedom and an opportunity to grow beyond. Isn't that right? So people who struggle in this way need to understand that they are understood by God and that there are solutions. It may not be easy or convenient, but there are solutions. Now that's just category one. Let's move on. What time do you have, Ron?
10:37.
Okay, we'll go till 11. It can, because, you know, when people get used by other people, the reaction is naturally a wounding and then anger follows. Well, that's right. It helps you explain. That's what I love about this kind of material. It helps you understand that if you do have struggles, there are reasons why. You're not bad, but you are human, and humans get wounded, humans are vulnerable. And also, the good news is that there are going to be solutions to these concerns that we'll look at. But let me continue, because we've got an awful lot to cover here before our break. Second problem, it's not sex, but it is a problem that happens before sexual sin, and it may linger after sexual sin, and that's the concern of emotional dependency. Emotional dependency is a condition that exists when you have an overattachment on another human being. Now, many of our men who struggle in sexual ways, they struggle with impulse problems. They have a hard time controlling their mind and body. But many of the women we work with struggle more in not the sexual stuff as much as the emotional overattachments. Now, I'm making an unfair generalization. There are obviously exceptions to everything I've said. But many women overcoming lesbianism, for example, they can stop the sex part relatively easily, we find. But they have a much more difficult time stopping the emotional overattachment on that former lover. And they can give me lots of excuses and reasons why they should maintain that relationship. Now, emotional dependency, of course, doesn't have to occur just in a lesbian situation. Emotional dependency occurs anytime you think all you need is one other person to be your source. Your own personal security blanket. Your own private oasis. Your own source. It's a major problem in the family of faith. Emotional dependency. Over-attachment on one other human as your source. But I thought husbands and wives should have that kind of relationship. And I would say you're mistaken. A bad marriage is when two desperately needy people look to each other as their source. I shouldn't say a bad marriage, I should say a troubled marriage, most likely. If you go into a marriage, if you go into a friendship, if you go into a cell group with a shopping list of expectations, you be there to meet my need. You be there to make me feel loved. You be there to satisfy me. And if you don't, I'll manipulate you with guilt or jealousy, or I will leave you and find someone else who will. That is the language of dependency, where you look to one other person as your source. Now, you know, the point is, we're all born desperately dependent creatures. You know, in the maternity ward, the nurse midwife doesn't say to that baby, "Well, child, don't worry about getting your nappy changed. Don't worry about your next feeding, because after all, Jesus is all you need." Now, we dish out this platitude to people, and that's cruel, because Jesus is not all that you need. Only a psychologically mature person who has been reasonably educated to know how to survive in life and who knows God well enough emotionally that they derive tangible emotional satisfaction from that relationship could make the statement, "Jesus is all I need." Jesus is all you need to be reconciled to the Father and to have your guilt covered. He's more than enough. But to grow up and be an educated, psychologically sound person who can navigate through the complexities of life, God has to work his intent through lots of other people who invest in a person's life. Isn't that right? We are born dependent. And so this is not often spelled out clear enough, because we are working with people in our churches who may be emotionally very immature, even if they are biologically grown up and psychologically, or intellectually grown up with great skill and intelligence. And biologically adult, the way that they connect to other people can be very childlike and thus very desperate and dependent. So I'm not being critical of dependent people. I'm saying they are very hungry people who look to others as a meal and a survival source. Are you with me? And with this, dependency can occur in spouse to spouse. The blokey bloke husband who wants to keep his wife barefoot and pregnant at home. Now, it's one thing if she wants to stay home and be barefoot and pregnant. You know, and they're in agreement, well, good on her. And good that he blesses her, and she has the opportunity to afford that. But now, if he doesn't want her to have a life outside the home, and he feels threatened that she does, and he uses his masculine aggression to control her, and also uses scripture to manipulate her, then we have an insecure little boy in a big man's body. Because men who are confident and secure don't treat their women like that. Are you with me? The Proverbs 31 woman is often pointed out as the woman of noble character. I want a Proverbs 31 wife, men will say. And women go to Bible studies and to GLOW meetings and women's conferences and talk about the Proverbs 31 woman. But you've got to understand something, folks. When that was written 4,000 years ago, there were not a GLOW meetings and women's Bible study groups and female Christian authors. This was written in a text read exclusively by men 4,000 years ago. And that Proverbs 31 woman, she was quite a woman. You know, she cared for a large home. Her husband was rich, and he had an influential position in the community, and she monitored the affairs of the estate, providing also for her family, and she had a real estate business on the side. Now, this story, as all Jewish writings imply very, very much by what is not directly said, this story is not at all about a woman. This is a story about a man, and the men understood it when they read it. Because that woman, her life and lifestyle was in sharp contrast to the way that women in Aramaic culture were treated as a piece of cattle and property. This is not the story of a capable woman. This is the story of a husband who loves his wife and trusts her and releases her to go and do and be. It's a story of a secure man who blesses his wife with the freedom to go and do and be. Are you with me? That's what the story is about. And the Hebrew men understood that in sharp contrast to the way women were treated like cattle. Because that woman wouldn't have been doing any of it if her husband didn't let her. And she wasn't just doing it at home. She was doing it in the community. Does that make sense? Then, secondly, emotional dependency can occur between parent and child. Getting back to the spouse thing for just a moment. You know, I've been married for 19 years. My wife and I are two very imperfect people, but we have a pretty good marriage. And one of the reasons why is because before my wife ever met me, she knew who she was in God, and she had an identity and a purpose and a life worth living before she ever met me. That meant that when she married me, while I hope to God I've become an enhancement and blessing to her, I am not her source. God is. She knew who she was before she ever met me. And that meant that when we got married, she did not look to me to be everything that she needed. She did not look to me to be her source. Does that make sense? Likewise, I love my wife. She has been nothing but a blessing of God to me. I don't deserve her. In fact, I love that old saying, what makes a good marriage? When both partners believe they got better than they deserve. And so, I love my wife, and she's been invaluable as an asset and benefit and enhancement to me. But you know what? She's not my source. Because if, God forbid, she dropped dead tomorrow, I would still have a life and an identity. I would still have a purpose in life worth living. It's not all wrapped up in here. All my eggs are not in that basket. But you'd be amazed at how many Christian marriages are not like this. How much, because they think, I'm supposed to depend upon my husband or my wife. If I can just find the right lover, the right spouse, then all my deepest needs will be satisfied and my drivenness will be resolved. And that is to make your spouse an idol. That is idolatry. Jonah chapter 2 verse 8. Jonah 2 verse 8 says, those who cling to their idol will forfeit God's grace. You know why? You'll live constantly in fear. What happens to my source? And that's where we become controlling. You can't have any other friends. That's where we become jealous. I can't lose you. You're my source. I can't stand it if you like somebody else, because then it threatens my standing with you. Or, no, I don't want you to travel on business. I'm afraid you might die, and then I'll be left without you. And you're my source. Are you with me? I'm not knocking people who feel this way. I'm just saying, if you feel this way, that's a signal that God understands, and He has solutions that you can be freer than that. None of us want our spouses to die if we love them. But at the same time, life is uncertain, and our spouse cannot afford to be our source. God must. Because every year, Christian marriages suffer the loss through death. Is that right? So, I love my wife, but she's not my source. God is. And it has to be that way. Jeremiah 17, verses 4 through 9. Cursed is the human who makes another human being his private personal source. You'll be blown about in a desert like a rootless tumbleweed, dry and fruitless. But if you are connected to God and rooted in the living water, then, even if nobody else is there to love you, you will flourish, because you will be emotionally nourished, because you're connected to the ultimate relationship. That's the interpretation of that verse. Now, what's the point in the verse? Isn't it true from Christian people who are even imprisoned that they can experience great emotional well-being even if isolated from others, if they know God and are fed through that relationship? That's right. You had a question? Jeremiah 17, verses 4 through 9. And then even Matthew, the book of Matthew, I believe around chapter 6, Jesus says you cannot have two sources, can't have two masters. And secondly, in Matthew, Jesus also says, you can't love anybody more than me, because if you do, you're not mine. He was not threatening. He was making a statement of observable fact. Isn't the first commandment you put God first? He's not a secondary serving as a pastoral caregiver in a particular community, and I had a client who became overattached on me, as sometimes happens. And there's where you have to set really firm boundaries. No, you may not call me 15 times this week. You may call me one time. And then you may call a friend, or you may call somebody else, but I will let you talk to me one time, and I will talk 10 minutes. And you can hear the desperation in people. Now, I'm not being cruel. I'm trying to teach them a better way. That I really am not the kind of source that they perceive. I'm not going to let them make me be their source. And I'm going to teach them that they will survive by learning to pitch their need toward God and develop a broader circle of resource than just me. So I don't let them dictate how I'm available. I dictate how I'm available. That's part of being a brother's keeper. If they don't know where the boundaries are, I will show them so that they don't burn me out and then I resent them. I teach them the better life skill in how they relate to people. Does that make sense? Well, one time, because I'm in the people caring business, because I do care about people, one time I made the mistake of giving out my home phone number. Now, you know, working in television and radio, I had TV and radio programs. I was on TV 3 times a week and had a nationally broadcast radio show in the States. And that means that when you have a higher profile, people feel a kind of an artificial sense of association with you, a familiarity, which means people want to track you down, that you're the one with their special answer. And I understand that, and I care about people. But my board, because sometimes I have a hard time saying no. That's the weakness of being a people caregiver. You have usually a hard time saying no. I do. And so my board would help me say no and throw a boundary for me that when you are home from work, Si, your public life is over, as are your public obligations. So you take the phone off the hook. You don't give out your number. Your home is not an extension of the counseling office. Your family needs you. There's a time to serve and then a time to be served. There's a time to serve outside the home. There's a time to serve within the home. Don't hope the phone doesn't ring. Take the phone off the hook. You know what I'm saying? See, the reason why I say this is that many Christians have a mistaken expectation. They think their pastor should be available 24 hours a day and that that's all they live for, and that the person calling is the only person with an issue. The Bible doesn't say that. Secondly, many pastoral workers also believe this mistaken belief that I'm supposed to be available to people all the time or I'm bad and fail Christ and my congregation. And the Bible doesn't suggest that either. The Bible says I am to go the second mile. The Bible says I am to understand and care for the burdens of the weaker brethren, and that I am to treat my neighbor like I'd like. But the Bible also says in Proverbs, you cross my doorway too many times, you wear out your welcome and become like a curse. In other words, wounded people also have to be taught boundaries. Is that right? Because see, here's what happens. People come into church, they are deeply hungry, deeply wounded, and we give them some love and time, and they take it. And then we give them a little more. And they take it. And we give them some more. And they take it. And pretty soon, and you know, you begin to resent them. Become afraid of them. Want to avoid them. Like, there's the vampire and I'm the blood bank. And then, of course, you feel bad. Oh, what kind of a Christian am I? Oh, I'm very selfish and carnal. Because if I really had the love of God in me, I wouldn't mind if they drained me dry of every drop of blood. Then we get slapped on both sides. We think we're bad for resisting, and then we don't resist, and they consume us. Isn't that true? Well, you know, there is a better way. And I had to learn it the hard way. I gave my number out to this gentleman out of a mistaken compassion, and he began to call me every night between around 11 p.m. and 1 a.m. Every night. Now, at first it was a crisis, and so, you know, I thought, if I'm in a crisis, I want someone to make time for me. If I'm in a crisis, I hope that somebody will care and sacrifice for my welfare, so that's how I treated my neighbor. But it ceased to be a crisis after weeks of this. Well, at least it ceased to be his crisis. And it began to become mine, and after the umpteenth phone call, and I hung up, good night, fuming, boiling mad. And my wife looked at me and she said, honey, why are you so mad at him? You expect him to understand where your boundaries are. It's obvious he is starving, and the last thing he actually considers is anybody else's need, only his own. And therefore, if you don't like him calling, you're going to have to tell him. Don't get mad at him and figure he's going to guess that you don't want him to call. If you don't want him calling here every night, tell him. I looked at my wife, I thought, gee, you and God, you're always right. And she was right. And so, inevitably, he called again. And I said to him, you know, I just want you to know that I think I've proven to you I care for you, but I don't want you to call in here anymore. I don't want you to call here at night like this anymore. If you want to talk with me, then let's go have a cup of coffee. Make an appointment. We'll go out and I'll give you undivided attention when I'm not so tired. Silence on the other end of the line. Then he said, I thought you cared. And I said, you know, typical manipulative, I do care, I said. I care to get some sleep. And he said, what kind of a Christian are you? And I said, a tired, limited, irritable human one who doesn't exist just to always be there on your terms. In other words, you want to have a relationship with me? Well, it isn't all one way, your way. Isn't that what we all have to learn in the way that we set boundaries for people? Because see, what happens is people go from church to church demanding, suffocating, manipulating, squeezing life out of people. And then we finally do reject them because we can't stand it anymore. They wear a blister in our soul. And then they say, there's no love in this church. And they go to another church and they repeat the same messy phenomenon over and over. Because we don't love our brother enough or our neighbor enough to draw a boundary for them. If they're going to learn to relate to people, it has to be in the give and take. Is that true? So I'm not trying to be mean. I'm doing something more than being polite. Better is a rebuke sometimes than kisses from an enemy, the Bible says. I didn't have to be mean to him. Now, what's the biblical illustration of this in the life of Christ? Jesus did not come to earth to drain the ocean of human need. All around Jesus were clamoring masses of people crying out day and night, "Heal me, Lord. Help me, Rabbi." Isn't that right? And there were times Jesus would go the extra mile and sacrifice his own sleep and welfare to serve the masses clamoring for his attention. Is that right? And you know what? Then there were times he would walk away from them. He would leave the wounded and the sick and walk away from them and leave their physical presence and go across the lake to hang out and have time with God and his disciples. There were times he would leave his disciples and go hang with God, or just one or two disciples. The point is, Jesus did not come to earth to be available to everybody who had a problem all the time on their terms. He came to earth to do the will of the Father, and sometimes that meant serve, and sometimes that meant withdraw. And that's why the average Christian worker today only lasts 7 years in ministry before they burn out, because they are boundaryless, thinking they must always be available to everybody all the time, or they're bad. And congregations are not trained to think differently. They expect, you should be available to me, that's what we pay you for. You should be there all the time for me or you're bad. And that's not the biblical model. Because sometimes God will deliberately keep a human being available to you so that you can connect to God in a way that he doesn't want anybody else to be a substitute for. Do I make sense? Okay. Now, next, before the break, the issue of childhood sexual abuse. Many of the people we work with have histories of sexual violation, as I mentioned. And I want to say that sexual violation doesn't necessarily mean that you've been deeply traumatized and your personality has been crippled. Some people, though, do suffer trauma from abuse. Here are three typical problems associated with sexual abuse in childhood. When you consider that 1 out of 4 girls and 1 out of 6 boys, and it may be even higher than that for boys, when you consider that number of people around us have been damaged through abuse, then obviously one of the most glaring lack of ministry in the modern church is understanding these things. So typically, people who've been sexually violated, they feel shame and a sense of inferiority. They feel like they're damaged goods. Now, when I say this, I'll never forget when a woman said to me in a seminar in another country, "Sai, I beg God to forgive me. I beg God to forgive me and cleanse me for my childhood sexual involvement with a relative." And I said, "Well, first of all, you didn't do anything wrong in the sense that you're guilty of, you know, you as a child would not be expected to have an understanding of your participation in sex with an adult. And probably you were powerless and couldn't have escaped the situation to begin with." I must say, not all sexual abuse means that it was violent forced rape, you know. Much sexual abuse is enticement. This is what happened to me. The adult man who sexually violated me did not rape me. He did coerce and seduce and entice. But still, the impact upon me was there. The point is, this woman described what many people feel. "I beg God to forgive me. I beg God to cleanse me. I beg God, you know, to forgive me for what I did." And I have to say to her, "You are not guilty." But she says, "I feel so guilty still." Now, I had to say, and I'm going to say to you what I had to say to her, what she's wrestling with is not guilt. In modern pop culture, in the age of Oprah and buzzwords thrown about in television and pop culture, we often use the misnomer. Misnomer means misused word. We misuse the word guilt in modern society. We say, "Oh, I ate too much and I feel so guilty." You do not feel guilt. Or, "Oh, I got caught doing that wrong thing and I feel so guilty." You're not feeling guilt. People do not feel guilt because guilt is actually not a feeling. Guilt is a legal condition. In other words, I can drive down this road out here and I can go 100 kilometers per hour. The speed limit may be 50. But I'm going 100 and I can feel no guilt. I, in fact, may feel pleasure. But when the policeman stops me, I am technically guilty whether I feel it or not. And when he stops me and I feel bad, I am not feeling guilt. Or if I've had a person say to me, "You know, if God thought that my relationship, this adulterous relationship, was sinful, surely I would feel guilt about it." I say, oh no, not at all. You can be involved in adultery and it can be quite emotionally satisfying and certainly physically pleasurable. You may feel no guilt, but guilty you are. Isn't that right? You see, guilt is not a feeling, it's a legal status. You know what you feel when you feel bad? You feel shame. Now, do you know why that little word play is very important? I'm not up here trying to play games with words here. Why is that distinction important? When you beg God to forgive you, He forgives you. The guilt is gone. You are not guilty anymore. It's over. When you ask God to put it under the blood, then our great high priest cleanses us from all unrighteousness, says the Bible in 1 John. Is that right? So when you still feel bad, you don't feel guilt. You're feeling shame. Shame is the psychological version of a burn to the skin. It stings for a long, regrettable time. And the only thing I know is to medicate the pain of a burn until it's all healed. And how do you medicate it? Painkiller. And what's the painkiller for the soul that's feeling shame? The presence of God. For in God's presence there is only peace. There is no shame. There is the assurance of love, and that God will take the bad thing and make it work for good. And just like some injuries need a lot more treatment and painkiller till they mend, some shaming events need to continually drive us into the presence of the Father that He may numb it and assure us. Are you with me? Because to me, that is the only remedy for shame. You don't talk people out of it. They need to get release. They need to have it numbed. And I find the presence of God and understanding those who have suffered with shame, that's a wonderful way to help them get a reality check. Because shame also breeds us to think wrongly. I've done a horrible, regrettable thing, and we often can't get out of the ditch of our thinking. And there's where we need a reality check. Do I make sense? Then, people who have been abused often struggle with heightened mistrust. It's very hard to even trust the character of God, many people feel, because they have been damaged. God allowed them to be damaged. And when I share my story tomorrow evening, I will share three reasons why the good God of love and power allows you to suffer in this life. Why the good God of love and power allows children to be molested, planes crash, and earthquakes destroy cities and kill people. Why good God allows all that. There are reasons why that are not taught to Christian people, and people, even non-Christians, have an expectation of God that if He's good and if He's love, He shouldn't let bad things happen, and God has never said that. God has said, I do allow terrible things to happen, and He gives us three big reasons in the Bible why. And many Christians don't want to look at it. We read very selectively, and we treat our Christianity as if it were a magic charm to keep us from suffering. That's right. And that is not Christian teaching. God tells us we will suffer, and He tells us why, even though He is love. And this is where there is the challenge to faith. Is God good when He gives you the baby you've prayed for? Or when the baby dies, is He still good? When you worship God on Sunday, driving here from your beautiful new home that God blessed you with, and then you go home and find it burned to the ground, is He still the same God that you worshipped the week before? Is God good all the time when there are concentration camps, children being molested, airplanes crashing? Is He good all the time? This is the challenge to us, isn't it? Because God says, I am good all the time. And circumstances would have us believe otherwise. And there's where in our churches are many people who want to know God better, who know they need to know God better. They are redeemed, but they run into a glass, invisible ceiling of distrusting God's character who allowed them to suffer. It's hard to yield yourself fully to somebody you don't completely trust. I won't give you my PIN number or let you babysit my kid if I don't really trust you. What about my wounded, tender soul? I don't want hurt anymore. There's a wonderful book called Sacred Romance, by authors Eldridge and Curtis. A wonderful book, and one of the chapters is called The Wildness of God. And in it, see, he makes the point, we equate Christianity with safety. We equate related to God with safety. God does not suggest this. Our eternal soul is safe, not necessarily our life journey. You know, in the great big play that our lives would be, will we still have important lines to deliver today, or will we survive this afternoon? None of us know. And God, you never know. He says in this chapter, God is rather like Indiana Jones. He seduces us with His almightiness and His charm. And then in the very next scene, we're dangling over a pit of vipers and He allows it. This is the truth about God, isn't it? He is good. And we are safe. It's just that how we perceive and expect isn't the same as what he said and delivers. Then, many of the people we work with sexual abuse histories, they have wrong associations. They have been defiled, and they feel that they are bad and inferior, but they also may think that sex is dirty and bad. Or they may think that all men are evil sex monsters. Or they may think that intimacy puts me at risk. They may think that to be a female is to be a victim. These are the many associations that are primal lies sown into people which cripple their function. Some people are scared to death of intimacy and refuse to relate. Other people, they have no boundaries and fall into bed too easily. All of it damage that can result from sexual violation in childhood. Plus, you know, you learn things you're not supposed to know. As a little child, I learned things I wasn't supposed to know about sex with men. And its effect upon me, you know, shaped the direction of my life. It wasn't my fault, but I had to suffer the consequences. Now, the time is? Well, why don't we take a 15-minute break? We'll reconvene at 11:30, and we'll probably go till 12:30 or 1, although we'll probably give you another break. I push you hard in the morning, because then it'll be easier in the afternoon, if you can bear with me. So what we're going to do is we're going to take a break. If you have questions, write them down, or you can ask them from the floor, but before we break, is there a question related to what we've discussed thus far? Have I been clear? When we convene, there are just two more points that we'll look at in this category. Yes?
Going back to shame and inferiority, yep. People, that becomes a value state. They need a closeness with God. They need to get back to God, but that becomes a barrier to God.
Indeed, and there's where God's people can become a reflection of God. That's why whenever we begin to open up and share these struggles in a safe environment with people we feel we can trust to the degree that we can, then when we learn that they accept us and that they can hear us and they're not there to lecture us, they can pray for us. They can begin to encourage us. Jesus said, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. He didn't mean that because he was God in flesh, but rather he was the incarnation of God, and so are we. That is, God is working through me, being represented to others. I may not be as clear an image to others as Christ was. But if I, who am corrupt, can care about you, if I can grieve over your losses, and if your pain matters to me, then if I represent God, then I have just represented, you know, to that person who may not trust God very well, a God figure. Do you follow me? It's why God works through people. People have a lot of baggage about God, but God working through people, if I, who am corrupt, you know, can be loving toward a person, then maybe they can believe God could actually be loving toward them too. And if you tell me of your struggle with masturbation and fantasy, and I'm not scandalized and horrified, but am understanding, accepting, empathetic, and have solutions, then how much more is God understanding, empathetic, and has solutions? So that's why God works through people that way, because it really paints a picture of the character of God when we haven't understood him and have had difficulty. I also think God delights to also sometimes just frankly intervene and wipe out the people in that sense and work directly by his Spirit. And there's where when we pray for people, one of the best things I can do as a pastoral caregiver is not give people insight into what I know. I can share my own journey, how I've been comforted. But I find that what people need is not information. They need a revelation that their lives matter to God. You don't have to have a revelation about the mysteries of the universe or your own ministry and calling as much as you need to know that your life personally matters to God. And when you get that revelation, that helps you face an awful lot. And it causes you to relax a lot more and know that God understands you, and that helps you move forward. Does that make sense? So one of the best things I ever pray for people is that God would speak to them, that their ears would be opened, that they could perceive him in the eye of their mind, and that they would receive from God. Because isn't that the point of redemption? It isn't just keeping out of hell. It isn't just living a moral lifestyle. It's that we know God and in ways that will affect us positively. So I don't want to put a burden on people to say, well, you have to know God better. That's not what I'm trying to say. I want to invite them to give to God what little crumbs they've got. Just like with the loaves and the fishes, Jesus didn't berate the little crumbs given to him. He took them and offered them to the Father, and God multiplied it. And I feel that if you can't trust God where you're at, then that's where you're at, and God knows it, and he already redeemed you knowing it. That means you can confidently approach him like you're at. I'm scared of you, God, and I don't trust you very much, but what little I have, I give it to you, and then he'll take it and he'll multiply it. This is what I love about God in my years as a damaged person coming to God with very little trust, is that God earned it. He didn't demand it. He earned it. And it became more. So knowing His character is what people need to experience. And there are various ways that can be accomplished. And I just gave you a couple, which I appreciate in the question. So shall we go ahead and take a break? Let's do it. See you here in 15 minutes. Enjoy your coffee.